Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Simon Stevenson, author of Set My Heart to Five, published in the States by Hanover Square earlier this month. Simon is the author of Let Not the Waves of the Sea, a very sad but uplifting book. He's also a screenwriter with many, many credits to his credit, and even has Set My Heart ready to go as a movie or perhaps a 16-season episodic series on Netflix. So Simon is also a physician, although he's been away from hospitals for some time, preferring to treat other ill people in Hollywood, of which there are. So, Set My Heart to Five is a book that some would call science fiction and others might call or have called the story of an ingenue in the broadest sense of the term, or a picaresque journey, to be redundant, of a bot named Jared, who as a dentist feels nothing. But as time goes by in 2053, our hero begins to have doubts about his programmed lack of empathy. And when 1956864 begins to cloud his cloud, even after a soft reset and a hard reset, something that I have to deal with weekly with Verizon after I've been on hold for 3 hours. I digress, as Jared might say. He realizes that something is amiss. He begins to feel. And after several sessions with his one human friend, a goofball named Dr. Glubdenstein, he realizes that after watching a score or so of emotionally manipulative movies, and measuring his tier output levels, that his goal and mission in life is to become a screenwriter, much like our guest. And even though he is just a glorified toaster with a heart, the pump kind of heart, he sets out to do just that. So welcome, Simon, and thanks for joining us today.
Wow, thank you for having me. I think that's the greatest introduction and summary of my book that I've ever heard. I think you're gonna have to come and do all my events with me, and that would be very helpful.
Yeah, I could introduce you. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I should do that. Be like being a professional consultant. So anyway, since it is kind of the title, why is it a toaster? And who says that they only go to five, since it is the title?
Yeah, very good question. So as you say, the narrator of the book, Jared, is an android. I wasn't a science fiction person, so I had to learn that an android is basically a human looking robot. And so Jared is what I'm calling a biological android, which means that his body is essentially a human body, like yours or mine. And the only thing that's different about him is his DNA has been manipulated. So the part of his DNA that codes for normal human consciousness has been replaced with some sort of computer programming code, some source code. One thing I learned in kind of my research for the book was that that source code does tend to sort of be, you know, copied and pasted between appliances. So for instance, you know, source code that's originally written to run a, you know, personal computer may then end up in a motor car running the electronics on that. So the idea is that Jared part of his programming is he wants to seem as reassuringly human as possible. You know, he's kind of thinks that's what's going to make people feel comfortable. And of course, it's the opposite. He's learned that humans, of course, we like to talk about our relatives. We talk about, you know, our parents, sometimes our ancestors. And so Jared's ancestor, where his programming comes from, his source code that he runs on was originally made for domestic appliances. And he particularly is enamored of the idea that it was made for the toaster. So when Jared says, set my heart to five, or set it to five, he's doing two things. He's paying homage to his ancestor, the toaster, and it's also five is his version of maximum enthusiasm. And it's great you picked up on that about, you know, do toasters go to five? Because all the toasters of my acquaint have always gone to five. But since the book came out, I've had more than a couple of friends send me photographs of, you know, toasters that go to seven or three or six. I mean, they never seem to go to 10, which is kind of strange. But Yeah, it turns out there is some variation in what toasters go to.
The first thing I did when I started the book was I ran downstairs to my kitchen to check it out. And then I read an article about it which said, if you think that these numbers mean anything with regard to the brownness of your toast, you're wrong. They have nothing to do with it. Well, so here's a question that's kind of off the mark. What do you have against Elon Musk?
absolutely nothing. I mean, I think that so as you're of course referring to, the book is set in 2053, 2054. And one of the things that's happened is Elon Musk has incinerated the moon. And in the book, I think it's described as a hilarious prank. And of course, you know, incinerating the moon is not a hilarious prank. It turns out to have consequences. The main one being we no longer have a moon. But I think in in my defense and kind of getting out ahead of the lawsuits here, I think it could have been any sort of, you know, playboy space billionaire that had incinerated the moon. And I think Elon Musk probably slightly drew the short straw simply because kind of the time I was writing that was right around when, I don't know if you remember this, but he launched a Tesla Roadster into space, and he had like a sort of astronaut looking person model put in the front of it. And, you know, there's that amazing footage of it just drifting off into the far reaches of the galaxy. And so, you know, I think it was, it seemed like the kind of prank he may potentially play. And then, of course, you know, he would realize it wasn't a prank and then, you know, say it was a terrible accident, but really it was a prank.
Yeah, and you might be right. I mean, he was playing, the Tesla was playing David Bowie's,
right. And I thought this was so dangerous that, you know, what we're sending out into the outreaches of the solar system is David Bowie and Teslas, because what's going to happen is the aliens are going to find this and think both those things are wonderful, and they're going to come rushing to planet Earth to, you know, capture David Bowie and take all of our Teslas, and they're going to find that David Bowie's no longer with us and hardly any of us get to have Teslas, and they're going to be furious.
And after I realized, you know, if you name your ship, your landing ship, Of Course I Still Love You, and the fairing catcher, Mrs. Stevens, I guess it's possible.
Yeah, so, there's definitely a sense of humor there. And I hope that'll extend to the lawsuits.
And also, just like Steve Jobs, the idea is to make a dent in the universe. And they both certainly did and have and will. Mm-hmm. You have to be asked this question, and it's in every review. So there's kind of like five persistent mantras that Jared employs, including exclamation points galore. One is his just simple ha, or this thing, or I was trying to get my 12-year-old daughter to say this properly. I cannot, but I can't say it the way you're supposed to say it. And 10-10 and the worst. So how you say I cannot the way it's supposed to be said?
So Jared would say I cannot.
And you know, it really is parlance now. And you know, but I'm so old that, you know, like I'm starting to tell, you know, I'm starting to say okay boomer, but it's gone. I haven't surfed the wave. I'm way behind. That's what happens when you become old. So why would a bot, that Jared is, although he looks and is built like a human being, why would a bot feel the need for this exuberance and also coupled with that, a major self-deprecating sense of humor? Why did you choose that to be his personality?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. I mean, I think as a society, we've become really cynical, right? You know, and we're all, you know, snark and funny, and it's hilarious. But, you know, I slightly miss some of the earnestness. And I feel like if I was in, because of course you can program an Android to do, you know, whatever you like. You could program it to be mean, or you could program it to be, you know, kind. But I think that you know, that sort of probably we will program them for, like, you know, unbridled enthusiasm. And I think we do already to a certain extent, like, you know, Siri and Alexa, for instance, are always just a bit too enthusiastic. Like, you know, the other day Alexa wished me a happy Monday. And I was like, well, of course it's not a happy Monday. It's 7 a.m. and I'm Scottish and there's an apocalypse on. You know, there's nothing happy about this. So I think partly it comes from that. And I think, yeah, just that sort of, like, the misunderstanding of what it means to be human. You know, it's just his best guess at it.
I've taught Alexa and Siri both to call me idiot, so that in the morning, she says, good morning, idiot. It just makes it better. I mean, it's so that everyone knows.
That's amazing. See, I wish I was able to do that, but honestly, I can barely get Alexa to play NPR at this point. So, you know.
It took me a couple of hours. So Jared, this Michigander, as he calls himself, and he thinks it's a great joke. He's a boring dentist. So you do very well in the book explaining this. So tell our readers why the powers that be, whoever they may be, other than his mom, why have they chosen that profession for him? And you can give his explanation.
Yeah, well, his explanation, I think, is that, you know, bots will make perfect dentists because they don't have any empathy. So they will get that tooth out every time, you know, that tricky wisdom tooth. You might complain it's too sore, and, you know, your human dentist might eventually be put off and say, okay, well, fine, come back next week and we'll do it under, you know, under general anesthetic. But, you know, the android is getting that tooth out there and then.
Yeah. Do you know dentists have one of the highest suicide rates in the world?
I didn't know that, but it actually doesn't surprise me. And I think because I know that there's a similar thing in doctors, but in doctors, it's quite specific within the specialties that it's anesthesiologists and psychiatrists are the two groups. Yeah. And the explanation that's always given is that anesthesiologists have the access to the most powerful drugs. You know, because they're every day using the drugs that, you know, can do that. And psychiatrists kind of know how to hide the signs. So with dentists, I think it probably makes sense because, again, they use, you know, incredibly powerful drugs that, you know, most doctors don't actually have access to.
And also, the other thing about dentists is no one wants to see them.
Exactly. Although I have to confess, I have a wonderful dentist here, and it's funny because, of course, being British in America, you know, our teeth are fairly notorious, and especially, you know, in Los Angeles, where everyone has the most perfect teeth in the world. When I first lived here, I didn't dare go to the dentist for a few years because I thought, you know, they just wouldn't let me out. I'd be in there for weeks. This is an emergency, and we have to start right now. So I finally, you know, I asked a British friend, and he said, yeah, I've got a dentist who specializes in British teeth. And what he meant by that was that, you know, he doesn't try and do everything. You know, he's not going for perfect. He's going for practical. So I went to see this guy, and he's brilliant. And, you know, of course, over the years, I've told him I've been writing a novel, and he's been very encouraging and supportive. And now we're kind of at the bit where the rubber hits the road, where I should have sent him a copy, but I have not mentioned the whole dentist thing, and I just don't know that I can. I don't know how to handle that now, because he's a wonderful dentist, so I don't want to lose him, but equally, you know, I'm not sure that if I send him this book, he will, you know, be willing to look after my British teeth again. So I'm in trouble.
I know. It's like so many authors that I've interviewed that have written books about people's brothers or mothers and fathers, and then they give them the book and they're devastated and angry and incensed.
Sure. Well, I wrote a memoir that my family featured very heavily in, and I was so worried about that for such a long time. And actually, what happened to me was the only people that were at all unhappy were the people that weren't in it very much. You know, there was kind of a sense of why do I only have a walk-on part? You know, I feel I'm more important than this, and that was the main complaint I got.
All right. Well, going to Jared then, as far as. Well, there really aren't that many walk-on characters, actually. A few. But you know, if you go back to his, again, self-deprecating exclamation explanation of himself when he calls himself a microwave oven with feet, a mobile telephone with arms, a toaster with a heart. I mean, I understand that, but I don't understand why. Well, obviously, after he has feelings, why I can understand why he wouldn't feel that way anymore. But why does he express it that way before he has feelings? He has the sense of humor that he wants to convey to human beings. But does he really have this underbelly of these appliances?
I think his code genuinely was originally used for, you know, domestic appliances. And then I think in those early bits when he's saying those things, I think he's just been programmed to say that, you know, his programming says that, you know, one way to make humans feel comfortable is self-deprecating humor. And so those things that he says about being a mobile telephone with arms or things like that, like, my hope is that they're self-deprecating humor, but they're also not quite right. You know, they're a bit too sad. Like if someone you knew described themselves like that, you know, I don't think you would be put at your ease. I think you'd feel awkward and you would say, you know, oh, don't say that about yourself. You're fine.
You're better. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. And I do this in every interview, but because I like the book a lot, I'm just asking you questions that I'm curious about.
Oh, please do. Yeah.
Yeah, but I forget about the listeners, which means I also forget about the fact that we're trying to sell your book.
Okay.
So I have to stop and then I have to go, like Terry Gross would do. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Sure. Yeah. Well. So I mean, I think we've touched on a couple of bases. I think maybe just, you know, I usually kick off by, you know, mentioning the whole that it's set in 2053, 2054. The thing I normally say about that is that I think people hear that and they assume that Brooke's going to be a dystopia. And I kind of always push back against that because I feel that I love dystopias. You know, I have shelves full of them and there's nothing better than, you know, putting down a book and realizing that you're not actually going to have to now fight children from other districts for your survival, you know, and it was all just a book. But of course we live in strange times and, you know, I would struggle to read The Road now, I think, you know, and so my conception of the future, I think, has been like slightly more hopeful, but also more, I think those dystopian books, they tend to sort of, you know, there's usually some devious ingenuity at the heart of them, the whatever the government's doing. And my feeling is that human nature is just, we just mess up so much more than that. And so in Britain, we have this phrase about cock up rather than conspiracy. And the idea being, yeah, that things are more likely to have, you know, gone wrong through error rather than deliberate malfeasance. And so I was trying to create a world that was a bit like that. So humans have locked themselves out of the internet by forgetting the names of their first pet and their favorite teacher. As we said, Elon Musk has incinerated the moon. And then we also have androids, but they're not the sort of, you know, genocidal killer robots that we've been fearing for the past decade. They're just, you know, kind of enthusiastic helpers who want to help. And us being humans, we're suspicious of them and treat them badly because that's what we do as humans. So, that's the sort of setting. And then, yeah, the book is narrated by Jared, a dentist android who, the one thing about androids is that they're going to be better than us at everything. So they're going to be better dentists, but they're also, you know, basically better, you know, anything to do with like science or maths or language or memory, they're going to have us beat. So the only advantage we possibly have as humans is our feelings and our emotions. And what that means is anytime any android shows any hint of feelings or emotions, we humans are going to be incredibly down on that. And we're going to be very protective of our, you know, our turf, our feelings and emotions. And so if an android shows any hint of feelings or emotions, then, you know, terrible things await them. They get wiped or incinerated. And that's, you know, ultimately that's the bind that Jared finds himself in. That's the crux of the book, is that Jared, you know, begins to experience some emotions and his adventures kind of all stem from that.
Those challenge questions, what I have found is effective in some of them is the first one I choose is the name of your first pet, which is Putney. And then I just answer.
Don't tell us.
And then I answer the next questions, Putney too. Putney also, I mean, just Putney. So I get all Putneys, but they sometimes catch you on that. But the one that really bothers me as far as my own intelligence is when it asks me to tell the number of fire hydrants in the grid. And I always, I can't find all the fire hydrants, nor can I. And then is part of the traffic light the post?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those things are just mind-blowing, right? And I saw one the other day that wasn't just still images anymore. It was video. They were like 9 little bits of video. And you had to, you know, watch each bit of video and say, oh, is there a fire hydrant going to appear here? And exactly, does that count? Is that technically a fire hydrant? I think every day at some point, you know, I'm locked out of some account of, you know, something that I've signed up for at some point. And I love the idea of just using the same password. That's really smart. Although, I definitely hope that you haven't told us your real one there.
I did. What's the difference? Everybody knows everything. It doesn't make any difference. I don't know if it's a sign of intelligence or stupidity that you can't find the fire hydrants. I mean, and that goes to Jared too, I guess. It's like, okay, is that a fire hydrant? Am I smart enough to think maybe it is or maybe it isn't? If I was dumber, would I be doing all of the above? And I like when they when you get it wrong and they repeat it again. And they go, if there's none, just say none. And then I don't know what to do. All right, this is what I do. This has, and I said I was going to say, and this is not right. So why? Okay, let's talk about, so the movies that the doctor sends him to, they're all manipulative tearjerkers. I hate love story. I always hated love stories.
Yeah, sure.
I saw it. Or anything by Nicholas Sparks. I mean, if you watch The Notebook, you don't want to like it, but then you like it, and then you feel horrible. It's like looking at pictures by Thomas Kincaid with the light. I always call him the masturbator of light instead of the master of light.
That sounds right. That sounds a perfect summation.
But so, yes, so these movies, for the first time, you wouldn't think a bot would be able to cry. But since he basically is a human being in so many senses and he measures them internally, it's the amount of tears that he and Amber shed that give him a good gauge as to the depth of his feelings. Correct? Maybe you could explain it better than me.
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. So the idea is that. When Jared begins to start to feel things, his friend, the doctor who you mentioned, Dr. Glunenstein, begins to think Jared might be depressed. And Jared says, well, I can't be depressed because I don't have feelings. And the doctor says, well, how about we do an experiment? And of course, Jared, being a scientifically minded android, says, brilliant, I love experiments. What's the experiment? And so the doctor packs him off to see a movie. And I suppose it's worth saying that in 2054, most movies are just going to be these multiplex blockbusters, you know, like a Marvel Disney Avatar crossover that's, you know, lasts for 4 hours and is the ninth in the series. And all of those movies are going to be about killer robots. So Jared, of course, says, well, I don't really want to see a movie about killer robots. And the doctor says, well, actually, there's this other kind of movie. And, you know, there still exist these, you know, wonderful sort of tumble down small art house theaters. And they show old movies, and old movies are movies which survived the great data loss that occurred when we all got ourselves locked out of the internet. And the reason they survived was because they were stored on film and not digitally. So what that means, though, is that the ones that will survive will mainly be the ones that they just had a lot of prints of. And so the films they had a lot of prints of would be the, you know, the big studio. And I kind of was drawn to the idea that, you know, my friends love to go to, you know, my cinephile friends go to you know, 7-hour black and white French documentaries in the Refugee Theatre and come back and I say, how was it? And they say, oh, it was great. I mean, you probably wouldn't, if it probably wasn't for you, you probably don't have quite the, you know, the understanding of, you know, French black and white documentary cinema to appreciate it, but I appreciate it. And so the idea that those same people will then be coming back and saying, well, I saw this wonderful film from 1996 about this great ship that sank, it was called Titanic. You wouldn't quite appreciate it because it's, you know, very intellectual, but I enjoyed it. So the idea is that, yeah, in the repertory theatres, it's those kind of movies that were once blockbusters that are playing. So, and as you say, the first one that Jared goes to is the movie Love Story. And like you, I have very, you know, very conflicting, or not even conflicting, you know, just I have opinions about that film. You know, Jared goes and, you know, he sees it and he comes back and the doctor says, well, how was it? And Jared says, oh, it was fine. And the doctor says, did you feel anything? And Jared says, no, of course not. I'm an android. And the doctor says, well, did anything happen? And Jared said, well, yes, I had about, you know, 57 milliliters of tears came out of my eyes, but it must just be allergies because I'm... And then the doctor says, well, I didn't tell you that the experiment that we did was a blind experiment where an important piece of information is concealed from the subject of the experiment. And that piece of information was that Love Story is a tearjerker. And so this puts Jared into a terrible bind because he's seen a tearjerker and he's cried tears. So, I mean, even the notion of a movie being a tearjerker and a book as well, the same thing, you know, there's a manipulation at the heart of that, isn't there? And I think Jared reacts to Love Story a lot more earnestly than I or probably most modern audiences would.
The one that he reacts to in a manner very similar to the way I would react to is Field of Dreams, because I can't understand it because it's so stupid.
I mean, it's an odd one, isn't it? It definitely is an odd one. I've never read the book. I'm kind of intrigued to read the book. I feel like the book probably, I would guess, probably manages to do it more delicately and, you know, in lyrical prose, it could probably make more sense. But I think Jared describes that one as a team of, you know, if you put something in your, if you build a baseball diamond in your cornfield, a team of disgraced zombie baseball players will appear. And this is supposed to be a good thing.
Yes. And also the other aspect, which you can't confirm because of your profession, is that I find that any movie that has Kevin Costner in it immediately becomes incredibly boring. And so that adds to, it's a combination.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good question. What are Kevin Costner's best films? It's a good question. I mean, I definitely have time for him and I admire him, but he has probably made quite a lot of fairly slow movie. I mean, The Untouchables, right? He's actually, you know what, he's in The Untouchables. It's probably his finest.
Oh,
album.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's another movie that Jared...
Oh, yeah, and he does that. The baby. The baby in the stroller. And I'm wondering, while that's happening in slow motion, I'm wondering, you know, it takes a long time for that baby. And what is she even doing there, the idiot?
Absolutely. I read an amazing thing about that the other day. That scene, they had something completely different written, and then they couldn't do it for some technical reason, so they just improvised that whole thing on the day.
It was. I forgot. I was just commenting on it. I forgot that was actually in there. But the best one, and the one the reviews hone in on, is Blade Runner, the original Blade Runner.
Sure.
Because that obviously, especially with regard to Rutger Hauer.
Yeah.
And that last scene, especially Tears in the Rain, which if you've ever heard him, well, now he's gone. But if you've ever heard him talk about that, you know, that was ad lib too, the Tears in the Rain arc, which doesn't it stay with you? All of that last soliloquy?
I think it's just one of the, you know, the seminal moments in cinema. Like I think, you know, if I had to pick, yeah, you know, five, that would be probably number one, you know.
Really? Me too. Yeah, and I, you know, I can't really say why is that, because it's so lyrical and you don't expect him to be as human.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And I think the combination, I think it's one of those things that cinema does so well of, like, you know, just that bleak, you know, whatever that futuristic Los Angeles is, and the contrast with, you know, what you think you know about this character and what he says. Yeah, it's stunning.
He does eat food, though, Decker. He does eat food. He eats those noodles.
This is true. He does eat lunch. That is true. Maybe that's not lunch, though. Maybe that's dinner. You know, lunch is for wimps.
But, oh, yeah.
But
okay.
He can have dinner.
That's an easy out for you. Hey, what's it like being compared to Terry Pratchett in these, you know, it must be cool.
Oh, what a dream. Like I, you know, and the funniest thing is, Terry Pratchett was really one of the first authors that I just absolutely adored. And, you know, in my probably my early teens, he was my guy, and I'd probably read just about everything. And then, of course, you know, he was so wonderfully prolific that, you know, somewhere along the way, I lost track of it a bit. And, you know, I turned whatever the age that you get diverted into the Beat Generation is, and kind of went off on this different path. So in truth, I hadn't, you know, I probably haven't read Terry Pratchett in really quite a long time. And it was so incredible, for someone to say, oh, well, you know, this puts me in mind of Terry Pratchett. And I was like, oh, well, that makes perfect sense. And I need to go back to it. And I feel guilty for having neglected it for so long, because I did. I always adored it.
Yeah, I know. And I saw Neil Gaiman at somewhere, and he was talking about his friendship with Terry Pratchett.
Yeah.
It was almost like a eulogy, but it was just that he was so bigger than life, and so funny and so kind. And I thought of that when I read the blurb or wherever I read it. Some other things Jared likes, and it's not, I don't know if it's going to, it won't translate to film, but his graphs and charts and his Venn diagrams.
Yeah.
What made you decide to go that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, as you say, the book has, you know, occasional diversions with some, you know, some as you say, Venn diagrams or bar charts. And I think the idea was just that, you know, as an android, Jared loves efficiency, and he loves kind of the efficient communication of, you know, of ideas. And sometimes a Venn diagram can communicate an idea way more quickly and efficiently than some prose, you know. And of course, it's also entirely inappropriate, because, you know, for instance, he draws this graph of how much alcohol his friend Dr. Gluckenstein has drank versus his topics of conversation. And, you know, we as humans wouldn't probably find that appropriate, but that's, you know, Jared sees that's the quickest way to get that information across.
Well, the other thing that goes to that is, you know, in the book, Jared doesn't understand the concept in game theory of, like, say, the prisoner's dilemma. The way he looks at it is that it's simply the toss of a coin and whether they match or not. So he's looking at the human race kind of laughably as a big, not con, but as a big zero sum game, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was really important to me, was, you know, the idea of that there are things that, you know, are very odd that we do as humans. And I think, you know, the fun of having the outsider perspective, and, you know, sometimes he gets them wrong, but, you know, I think there's probably a bit of truth in it, in the, you know, the idea of, you know, Jared sees that humans are just always competing with each other for, you know, sometimes fairly absurd things. Whereas if they, you know, the logical thing to do would be to cooperate. And yet, you know, instead we choose to build the system where, you know, we all have to, you know, try and beat each other.
There has to be a loser.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Which interesting, like this is one of the things that, so you know, I've lived in the US since 2013, and, you know, I love sports, and I've got really into some American sports. But one of the things that's fascinating to me is there does always have to be a winner, and there always has to be a loser. Whereas, so in, like, if you go to a match in the UK, And at the end of full time, the score is, you know, 2-2. Everyone has 2 goals. Then unless this is like a very special, you know, World Series match or something, then that it's a draw. We just agree it's a draw. Both teams played well and everyone gets 1 point and goes home. Whereas in America, you know, if I go to the Dodgers, if they're tied at the end of the ninth, well, the bottom of the ninth, as I should say now, I'm an American, you know, they just keep playing until someone wins and someone loses.
Yeah, people in America can't understand the concept. Well, I can't understand the concept of cricket at all. But one thing they can't understand is the concept of stopping the game at lunchtime and perhaps having tea together.
It's absurd, isn't it? And so I'm Scottish, so we don't really play cricket because it's mainly English, and it also requires, you know, you basically need 4 sunny days in a row because often the game goes over 4 days. And, you know, I think the last time we had 4 sunny days in a row in Scotland was probably in the 1800s. So, yeah, cricket is not a sport for us.
I'll never even understand what a test match is. Don't even tell me. Don't even bother. I don't even know what innings are in cricket. And I understand why the wall, there is no wall. It's just those little bumps.
A little rope, yes.
Okay, I'll stop there. But here, I'll go back to the book. Since you're talking about sports, is Tom Brady.
And sure.
What the hell were you thinking? I mean, how did you decide you're going to shove the greatest of all time into that book?
Sure. Well, I think, again, like as with Elon Musk, it kind of just, you know, I was probably sitting there thinking about, you know, how do we extrapolate the future from what we know now? And of course, so Jared lives or he starts out the book living in Ypsilanti in Michigan. And one of the things about them is they do have a college football team. They have the East Michigan Eagles. So, you know, Jared is kind of already a bit interested in football. And I suppose I was thinking that, you know, given the data that's coming out about, you know, how horrifically dangerous this game can be and, you know, some of the consequences that occurs, it sort of seemed like a logical thing that, well, if we want to keep, you know, having people crashing into each other with that force, let's just make our bots do it. You know, this is a perfect job for androids because they're dispensable. And then you think, well, where will they, you know, where will they get the bots from? Whose DNA will they use? And of course, you know, if you're gonna make, you know, a bot that you want to get your money's worth, so you want DNA of someone that's, you know, really good and also is gonna be able to play for years and years and years. And so, you know, there's only really, I mean, Tom Brady's the big one I know, but of course, it was also happening, I have to confess, right around about the time I was writing it around, you know, I think it wasn't long after what became known as Deflategate. So, you know, that probably colored some of in the book, the clones of Tom Brady are sort of, you know, the villains everybody loves to hate.
Yeah, and it's like last week when it was Drew Brees versus Tom Brady, their combined ages were 84 years old. Which,
isn't that amazing? I mean, something's happening as humans, right? We're doing better. We have soccer players in the UK that are in their 40s as well now. It's incredible.
I know. And you have field goal kickers who are the same age kicking 61-yard field goals. And they're usually soccer players.
But, sure, yeah.
So I was going to say, oh, yeah, this this is what humans do in an illusory way to eliminate the concept of the zero-sum game. Like the doctor and other people, they still do go Eagles, even though the Eagles have never won.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and it's true that if you look up the East Michigan Eagles, they are, I think, notoriously one of the historic, I mean, I think they do okay now, but I think historically they have one of the longest losing streaks and just one of the worst records. But, you know, I come from Scotland, as I said, and, you know, my soccer team that I support, you know, rarely, I mean, they do okay, but, you know, they haven't won the league in, you know, living memory. And it doesn't dim my passion for them, you know?
Yes, the Chicago Cubs, especially since you're now a sports fan. And here's another one-off. I find that I am allergic to gluten-free foods. Gluten-free foods make me deathly ill. And Jared makes fun of that too, which I assume you are not. You are not gluten intolerant.
So I am not gluten intolerant, and it's I mean, it's unfortunately, it's probably it's a little bugbear of mine, I think, from there is, you know, as a physician, I know full well that there's a very serious illness called celiac disease, where you are, you know, genuinely unable to tolerate gluten. And, you know, we know you have celiac disease because there's, you know, there's tests for it. And, you know, I think those people, you know, that's a tough thing to have. And, you know, we all as a society should, you know, do all we can to help them. But of course, living here in Los Angeles, most people I know seem to be gluten intolerant. And I don't think that, you know, if you did the test, I don't think most of them would have this condition. So it's a sort of, it's a kind of gray area. And it's interesting that I'm the same. Gluten seems to be quite tasty to me. Like it seems quite an important, I don't quite know exactly what it does, but it seems quite an important ingredient in things.
Yeah, non-gluten brownies taste like crap. They're hard.
Yeah, but sure.
It's funny, like all these things we have now, like when I was a kid, no one was allergic to peanuts. I don't want to be banned from peanuts because one kid in my class. So no one was allergic to peanuts. No one had ADD. They were just bad kids. Otherwise, I would have been taking Adderall when I was 18 months old. There was no TMJ. There was no carpal tunnel syndrome. There was no mitral valve prolapse. There was none of these things. But now there was no Epstein-Barr. There was no chronic fatigue syndrome. You were just lazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, isn't it because, like some of those things that you mentioned, like I could definitely make a strong case for, you know, those have always been with us and they've always been real. But I think the real danger that I always found was that, like, terms get co-opted. So, you know, and I need to be really careful what I say here because there's, you know, vast, you know, lobbies around things. But, I guess there's certain gluten sensitivity is the classic one. There's lots of things that people, you know, self-diagnose themselves with, and then, you know, medical science can't offer them anything, and it just becomes an endless thing that everyone, you know, yeah, I think in 20 years time there won't be gluten, you know, maybe it's gluten, who knows.
Well, it's like, what if this interview puts you into a cancel culture kind of category? You would never be able to be a screenwriter again, and you would never be able to write a book again. If I get you to say the worst thing possible, I could actually.
Absolutely, how terrifying! I mean, I just joined Twitter lately, to promote the book, and you know, I think I'm like a, you know, I don't think I have, you know, bad opinions, you know, and you know, I'd love to think I'm a, you know, kind and caring and tolerant person, but nonetheless, everything I tweet, like, I always have to give it the old, you know, the once over to say, like, is there any way in which this could entirely accidentally be misconstrued to mean something which is, you know, not what I mean at all, or the other thing?
Yeah, that's why she always has been. I own an independent bookstore, and while I love Harry Potter, it's not so much that I love it, it's that because kids read it, they begin to read more. So they'll read. But now she's been, because of her remarks, her whole life has changed, and she sticks to her guns, and she says, look, you're born a woman, you're a woman. That's apparently a horrible thing to say. It's really a horrible thing to say, and, you know, screw that, you know. But, and the good thing about her is she's not changing her mind. She reiterates it. She says, and she is, she's entitled to say that. But, and your book kind of is a touchstone for that in a way. I don't know why exactly, but I think it is. But I don't know why.
Oh, yeah.
Because it holds us up. You know how some people, I'm not going to mention our president. Well, like, if I start talking about him, then that's the end of the interview. But so you don't have any perspective. You can't step outside yourself and look back in. And that's what Jared does. He forces the reader to...
Yeah. And I always think about that, you know, and I'm so glad that that's, you know, that's what's coming across, because, you know, I always wonder about, like, you know, what are the things that, you know, because we look back at, you know, people from 50 years ago, or 100 years ago and think, well, those idiots, they were so naive, you know, so did terrible things. And I kind of wonder, and we consider ourselves like as if we've arrived at this moment of human perfection and civilization, when, of course, you know, assuming any of us is still here in 50 years or 100 years, people are going to look back at us and think, well, how on earth did they tolerate, you know, this? And one of them, I think, which Jared picks up on is the motor car. Like Jared's sort of, you know, baffled by the idea that so humans used to be allowed to, you know, get in these 2-ton hulks of metal and the speed limit was 70 miles an hour, but they could drive them at speeds of up to 140 miles an hour. And, you know, millions of humans, you know, died in various ways from these things. And that seems to be something that, you know, as a culture where we tolerate, you know, we tolerate an awful lot of road deaths. And obviously that's changing, I think. But I feel like those are the kind of things, yeah, that outside perspective, you just think, well, why does this car go up to 140 miles an hour? Like, what's the use of that?
I remember trying to explain to my daughter that our cars ran on dinosaurs. Perfectly in there. Why?
Yeah, absolutely. Which is just the most ludicrous thing, right? Like if aliens came down and said, "Well, so what's powering these things?" Say, "Well, over there, you know, if you go over there, they're digging this stuff out of the ground, and then you know we boil it for days, and we get the specific bit of it, and then we sell it to each other, and they can put it in the car, and it can make the car go." And I think aliens would be like, "Well, what about the sun? Why don't we just use the sun? It's right there. Just use the solar power. That's what we do. We've been doing that for, you know, thousands of years in our perfect alien civilization."
Who was the guy that John Cleese debated? He's a religious guy. He's very religious, and it was a great debate, but I forgot who it is.
Oh, I don't know about this.
Common name in England. He's an archbishop, but I can't remember what his name was. But anyway, it was an excellent debate, but they were talking about the life of Brian, and he goes, yeah, there's certain names like Brian, which I felt sorry for all the Brians in the world.
Sure.
And he gave several names. That's the kind of name Brad is. So when he becomes Brad Smith, it's the perfect name for him. And so the reason I ask is I was thinking about my daughter again. She's a busser now, and she cleans dishes in a restaurant, and that's what Brad ends up doing. So let's lead into, I know I'm going on forever, but let's lead into the anomalous Amber and talk about her, because I love her.
Yeah. So as you say, Jared, you know, he goes on an adventure, he finds himself in Los Angeles, and he ends up working in a restaurant. And it's interesting that your daughter does that job, because I've done that job. That's all that stuff is in the restaurant is actually drawn from life. When my first job ever in the United States in 1998, I spent the summer working on the Outer Banks of North Carolina in a family restaurant, both in the kitchen, and then eventually I got promoted to waiting tables, but I was so bad at that, I got sent back to the kitchen fairly swiftly. And it's funny, isn't it, the way that stuff sort of, you know, stays with you, that, you know, like 20 years later, it was actually super useful to have had that experience. In terms of Amber, one of the reasons Jared sets out on his mission is because when he begins to feel, he really enjoys the feelings, you know, he's, you know, particularly loves Schadenfreude, the German word for taking pleasure in the small sufferings of others. Great, absolutely, yeah. And of course, he then, you know, because only the Germans have a word for this, he thinks, oh, the Germans must be the most fun people on earth, you know? But in amidst all these feelings, he has this other nagging feeling. And he realizes eventually that this feeling that he has is a thing called loneliness. And when he sees the movie Blade Runner and watches these feeling androids, that's when he kind of, for the first time, he feels, wow, you know, during the time I was watching those people like me up on screen, I did not feel lonely. And maybe, you know, maybe there are other people out there like me, and I have to go and, you know, set out. So Jared's quest in many ways is, you know, trying to put an end to his loneliness. And he makes a couple of friends in the restaurant, and one of which is his fellow dishwasher, and then the other is this waitress called Amber. And I guess there's a question of how much we want to say about Amber. I'm happy to say things, but you know, she's a mysterious character for Jared to become acquainted with.
Yeah, I was going to say this is really the only spoiler that I could force you to do, and I'm glad to do it. But we could talk about, yeah, and this is a very interesting thing in the book because I didn't expect it and I don't quite understand it, is the reverence that Jared has for his mother, if you can call her his mother.
Absolutely. So Jared is sort of weirdly obsessed with his mother. So he's always his mother is a scientist who, you know, developed the technology on which he's based, and she is based at the University of Chengdu in China. And the reason for that is because, of course, China were smart enough not to have locked themselves out of the internet. So you know their technological progress has been incredible. Anytime, you know, a bit like the toaster, really, I suppose Jared likes to, you know, he thinks people, you know, humans like their mothers and are, you know, proud of them. So he's always like inappropriately mentioning his mother's great scientific achievements. And then, of course, the other part is, you know, she is the one who programmed them. So, of course, you know, if I was making an android, I might make the android feel like I'm pretty great. You know, I might build in a little bit extra code to just say, you'll always be particularly reverent to me and tell everyone how wonderful I am. But then I think, you know, the other part to it is it's also, I think, maybe part of his emotional awakening and perhaps an early hint that, you know, he's not quite as unfeeling as he's supposed to be.
Yeah, if you ever did season 6 on Netflix, you could go to his mother and tell the story from.
Isn't that amazing that like that's something that can happen now in terms of storytelling? Like I love that, you know, because of course you know we are very familiar with, you know, like, you know, ER, you know, I watched whatever 15 series of ER, and they're all the same. They're all in the hospital. So you know, they're all set in the emergency room in the hospital. And I love that when they do that now, that like, oh yeah, series 1 is this, and you know, series 2 is on Mars. You know, series 2 is just just a different thing. So I think that would be a great spin-off.
The other thing is Inspector, well, I guess there are a lot of interesting characters that are really well fleshed out, is Inspector Ryan Bridges, who, when you first meet him, is just this incompetent idiot. But he turns out to be like Tommy Lee Jones in The Fugitive. He just tracks.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah, he gets on it. Yeah. I think that's really interesting that you picked Tommy Lee Jones there, because I think that's right. I think that kind of was, you know, slightly the model. Like, maybe I probably had slightly more in mind Harvey Keitel and Thelma and Louise, who's but I think it's essentially the same kind of storytelling, that, you know, you're with your protagonist, but you know that, you know, there's this threat that's kind of creeping towards them. And I think that's the technique from the movies, yeah.
Who's the guy? It was his last day at work. It was the movie Falling Down with...
It's Michael Douglas.
Yeah, and then the detective, which... Robert Duvall.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Yeah,
same thing. Because it's his last day, but he can't let go of it.
Yeah,
really. There is that archetypical cop who just can't let go.
Absolutely, yeah, and I didn't, you know what, I missed the trope. I should have made it Bridges last day as well. That would have been the real, you know, if we're playing with sort of, you know, those things, that actually, yeah, maybe it should have been his last job before retirement. That would have been fun.
Yeah, and then, and actually, if you think about, well, this is a spoiler, but I was going to say, with that movie, and if you think about a certain aspect of the book, it's kind of very similar, actually.
Absolutely, yeah.
Never thought of.
Ah,
right?
Sure. No. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's part of, you know, the fun of like kind of playing with those. One of the things that, you know, I've sort of, you know, as a screenwriter, I'm just increasingly so aware of is that, you know, it's all so often the same story. And, you know, the challenge is finding a different spin on it or a different way to tell it or something surprising.
Well, this is a different way. I mean, there's supposed to be whatever it is, seven different stories, but this is kind of different. And again, it's because of, it's the exposition and this ability to have perspective. But also, since you are a screenwriter, there's a screenplay in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we have some sections that are in screenplay. The reason for that was, again, I don't think I'm giving too much away when I say that, you know, part of Jared's journey is deciding, you know, he loves movies and he's going to write his own movie. And so, you know, screenwriting is a theme in the book. And it felt like, you know, writing about that, it was one of the things that, well, why not just show it? Like, why not show it on the page? And then that gave me this thing that I wasn't expecting, this benefit where, because I think with a novel that's narrated and novel and voice, obviously you can have your character saying, and then I felt this, and then I felt that. But sometimes it's more powerful not to hear it from them. You know, sometimes it's more powerful to kind of take the camera out of them and just see some of the pivotal events happen to him. So that was part of that. And of course I thought, you know, I'm a great literary genius and I've invented this whole new genre and, you know, I send over the New York Times journalist for the profile. Of course, actually, it turns out this has been done lots of times before. The one I was personally familiar with was Truman Capote has a book. I think it's Music for Chameleons. In the back half of that is this conversational portrait series where he says that he's been working as a screenwriter and he wants to kind of use his prose skills and his screenwriting skills. So it's things like he spends a day with his housekeeper and writes about her and then also has their dialogue in prose. And then the same with Marilyn Monroe. But actually going even further back, someone pointed out recently that in Moby Dick, there's a chapter in Moby Dick.
Oh, yeah.
To a stage play. Yeah. So as ever, Herman Melville got there first.
Yeah. I interviewed this guy who wrote like, why read Moby Dick? But he was obsessed with it. And he said that everything in the world that happens, you can track back to Moby Dick. And I said to him, so like the election and what's going on now? He goes, yes. And it was like, and also there's one spot in Moby Dick where Herman Melville breaks the fourth wall.
Oh, wow. I didn't even remember that.
There isn't. You can't remember. He says he's sitting at his desk looking out the window, but it's like one paragraph. So
brilliant. I'm gonna go back and read it. I've been meaning to read it for a while again because it's so funny. Like I've read it a couple of times and each time I was so blown away by like the humor. You know that you don't expect it's going to be funny. You think, well, I'll better do my work and read Moby Dick because I'm supposed to have read it because everyone's read it. But yeah, I truly loved it and I think it's going to be fun to check out again. And I'll look for the modern parallels.
As well, it's like James Joyce Ulysses. I mean, I would love to read it again, but I really.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Ulysses, I wouldn't love to read again. You see, Ulysses, I feel like, oh, I did that. That's okay. That one's off the tick. You know, I can put my hand on my heart and tell people I read it. But the Moby Dick, I did actually enjoy.
Yeah, it's funny how, like, everyone remembers the last lines of Great Gatsby, and everybody remembers Call Me Ishmael.
Yeah.
Except I used to tell my friends it was Call Me Fishmeal, but
that's how I'm going to read it from now on.
Well, so when you did the screenplay thing, I'm skirting around the possibility of spoilers, but so what happens to Jared's screenplay after its pickup? Do you ever feel that way?
My take is basically I like to say that I've had sort of, you know, the full gamut of screenwriting experiences here in Hollywood, which is everything from terrible to awful. But actually, I'm kidding a little bit because I've had some wonderful experiences as well. But you know, classically the, you know, the classic role of the writer in Hollywood lore is not to be treated well. And that, you know, I think that continues to this day. You know, Jared in the book has an algorithm where he works out the algorithm for screenwriting, and the top box is, or rather it's actually the algorithm for film producing, because the top box is everything going as well as it possibly can with the movie, question mark. And then there's two arrows, yes and no, and they both go to the same box. Have you tried replacing the writer? And then they both go down to the next box, which is replace the writer. And so, and I think that's probably like a reasonable summary in lots of ways of some of the experience. I would say though that actually, I think you mentioned that, you know, this book has been optioned for film, and that's actually been, you know, so far like a really incredibly great experience. And partly I think it's fun because I often write things as screenplay first, and then that means that, you know, your version can just disappear when, you know, five other writers have, you know, had their shot at it. Whereas, you know, the book exists. The book is out in the world now. And, you know, that was my story. And now the film, I'm very excited to see, you know, what the version the director makes of it is.
Yeah. I think, like, yes, you let the book into the world, so your firstborn is out there.
Exactly.
He's out. And well, it's like you were saying about reading the book Field of Dreams. I don't know which way is better. I think reading the book first is always better, but I don't know.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I genuinely do both though. Like I'm not someone who won't read a book because I've seen the film. Sometimes I'll see a film and I think that's interesting. I'm really intrigued to see. And funny enough, the last thing I did it with was, I watched the TV show Sharp Objects, you know, the Amy Adams, from the Gillian Flynn book. And I loved the TV show so much that I was like, wow, I really want to, you know, get to the bottom of this. And I read the book and I devoured it. And it was, you know, it was great in like a slightly different way, because again, it was the transition from a first person narrator to the, to the big screen. So I'm definitely someone that would still seek out the book after the movie.
It's really funny, when I interviewed Gillian Flynn before Gone Girl got popular, we talked like we're talking, it's now an hour and 4 minutes, I'll let you go. But then the second time I interviewed her, everything changed.
And the publicist
goes, she has a 15-minute hard out. And the publicist stayed on the phone the whole time, and when it's 15 minutes out. Same thing with Paula Hawkins with The Girl on the Train. First time, we just blabbed, and the second time, nope. She's got to go.
That's so sad, isn't it? In a way, because I'm sure she would have probably preferred to, you know, have a nice free-ranging conversation with you as well. And
this will probably be the last one I have with you.
never. We'll always do our.
You have a heart out. I love that, because it's the jargon that you guys use all the time.
Yeah, there's all those. I mean, I think there's a book in there. There's a bit in the book where Jared talks about, you know, how people in Hollywood make up their own language to make everything sound more important than it is. So, like the cafeteria on the studio lot is called the commissary, you know, just because that's, you know, makes us feel special. And I think it's the same with all of that, and the hard out, and all of that stuff.
Okay, so since it's been an hour five, I'll do now. Here's what I usually do, I'm telling everybody. I'll end it as if you're being interviewed by Terry Gross. So I'll say, I'm saying now, this is what I'm actually saying now. We've been talking with Simon Stevenson about his new book, Set My Heart on Fire, which I strongly recommend that you read as soon as possible. But I will add that since I do have an independent bookstore, your book, we're open again, finally, and your book is sitting out there on the front table. And if you ever get back this way, I would love to have you at the store.
Wonderful. Well, I would, you know, I would love to come, and I'm thrilled to hear that the book is in the store. So yeah, thank you for your support, and it's been such a fun conversation. So I hope we get to do it again.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon then.
Great. Thank you so much.